Okay, everyone, so again, welcome to the Resac today. And I'm going to continue the talk I started this morning, continue with the same kind of theme. And for those of you who weren't here this morning, I was basically talking about the life of the Buddha. What was the Buddha's real life? Who was the real Buddha? And why is it that we can actually find often so much more inspiration in the life of the real Buddha than we can in the legendary Buddha that we so often hear about? Because, and the reason for that is because you will find, when you look at the life of the real Buddha, that he was indeed very much like the rest of us. He had his sufferings, he had his problems. He was a person, very much of flesh and blood, like all of the rest of us. And of course, when you realize that, you realize that the way he lived his life, the way he was able to attain enlightenment, the way he was able to overcome suffering, overcome those problems that we all have, they become a lesson for us as well. Because he was a human being, we can follow exactly the same path that he was doing. He is not radically different from us, a god or some kind of unfathomable being anyway. He is a human being like us. But at the same time, I was also saying this morning that there was, of course, there was something special about the Buddha. And what was special about the Buddha was that he had very powerful spiritual qualities. Now the good thing about these spiritual qualities, that these are not kind of fixed entities, permanent kind of qualities in anybody, so there's nothing you can do about it. Spiritual qualities is something that we can all develop. And because there are things we can develop, again, the Buddha becomes an example for us for how we should practice, what we should do with ourselves to also attain those same spiritual qualities, to make progress on this path of Buddhism. So in this way, we can actually, the Buddha becomes like a beautiful example for us, something wonderful that all of us can aspire towards practicing the same way. We can get inspiration from his life story, and we can actually look to the Buddha and try to practice almost in the same way that he did. Now that is one part of the thing which is important with the story of the Buddha. The other thing, when you hear the story of the Buddha, there's lots of little Dhamma points on the way the Dhamma was taught, the way the Buddha taught this thing, which is very inspiring and very interesting to take note of as we go along. So this morning, when I was talking, I got up to the Buddha's enlightenment, and now I want to talk from the enlightenment to his parinibbana. So we have already seen two of the big events that we are commemorating here at Vesak. We have seen the Buddha's birth, we have seen enlightenment, and now we move towards the final event, the parinibbana, the main passing away. So what happened after the Buddha was enlightened? Some of the interesting thing, one of the first thing that happened after the Buddha was enlightened was that he was thinking to himself, this which I have found is just so profound, it is so hard to see, nobody out there is going to understand it, why should I teach it to anybody? This is the first thought in the Buddha's mind. And when you hear that, straight away you wonder, oh, this is interesting, because usually we're taught that the Buddha was a bodhisattva. He's been teaching for four eons about, always practicing for the welfare of others. But when you see what the suttas say about it, the suttas actually say that the Buddha, when he went forth, the idea in the Buddha's mind was not to practice for the welfare of others. The idea in the Buddha's mind was to practice for the end of his own suffering. The Buddha said, I am subject to suffering. I'm subject to death. I'm subject to defilement. And this is what I want to make an end of. That was what the Buddha said in this one particular sutta. So his motivation all along from the beginning was to find the end of suffering in his own life for himself. And if you think about it, it makes eminent sense. Because how can you even think about teaching others unless you find a solution to the problem yourself, first of all? First you have to understand that there is a problem, then you have to find a solution to the problem. And if the problem has a solution, then you can start teaching others. If you don't even know that there is a solution to the problem, how can you say, I will teach, I will practice for the welfare of all human beings even before you found the solution? So from that point of view, it makes eminent sense that the Buddha's first priority was to find the solution first of all, and then afterwards, obviously, to see what happened after that. And what happened was that he realized this Dhamma was so profound, he didn't think anybody else in the world would understand it. And he said to himself, if I go around teaching this Dhamma, which is so profound, to all these beings and nobody understands it, it will just be troublesome and wearisome for me. So the Buddha inclines not to teach. It's interesting to note here as well that the Buddha says it will be troublesome and wearisome for me. And of course the reason is that for anybody in this universe, it's much more pleasant to sit in deep states of meditation where there's pure bliss and you're just blissing out, rather than having to wander around teaching people, experiencing maybe physical pain in the body and all kind of disturbances. And that's the same for the Buddha as it is for everybody else. There will be some disturbance by the very fact of having to have experience in this world. And the Buddha also would prefer to just sit down and bliss out in deep meditation. So the Buddha decides, well, okay, I think maybe there's no point in teaching, so I won't teach. And then, of course, the story is that this god, this Brahma Sahampati, he reads the mind of the Buddha and sees that the Buddha is inclined not to do anything for the world. And he thinks to himself, the world is going to perish. In other words, there's not going to be anybody to teach this beautiful Dhamma. Because Brahma Sahampati, he understands this Dhamma. He was apparently a stream enter himself in a past life. So he goes down to the Buddha and says, please, open up, please teach, because there are beings out there who will understand it. And then, having happened, the Buddha then surveys the world. And he sees, indeed, that there are beings who will understand this particular teaching. So, we can see here that the whole motivation of the Buddha for teaching, for doing anything at all, is compassion. Once you arouse that compassion in the Buddha, because remember the Buddha had found the problem, he had found the solution to the biggest problem that there is. He had found the solution to the ultimate answer to this problem of suffering. He had found the profoundest happiness that is available in this universe. And because he had found that, obviously he had something to teach other beings that was extremely profound and extremely important. So once once somebody comes down and rouses the compassion in the Buddha and shows him that this teaching actually will have an effect on other people, then of course the Buddha goes out and teaches this thing here, because it is such an important and profound teaching here. And so the Buddha essentially, what is the Buddha? It occurred to me that the Buddha essentially is like a compassion, just one big blob of compassion basically. His five aggregates consisting of compassion. The whole purpose of the Buddha after he is enlightened is just compassion. That's why he exists. He exists to help other beings. There is no other reason. And if he didn't help other beings, he would just be sitting there and meditating by himself, and nobody would actually even know that he was enlightened. So it's like almost like a compassion machine, maybe you can say, a Buddha. It's just that's one way of looking at the Buddha, one angle. So the Buddha then goes out and he asks himself the first question after he decides that he's going to teach, who should I be teaching? And the first persons that he decides to teach are his previous two teachers, who are known as Alara Kalama Uttakaramaputta. These are the people who taught the Buddha meditation before he decided to go on his own and practice to enlightenment. And of course the reason why the Buddha decides to teach these particular teachers is of course out of gratitude. Because these teachers helped the Buddha on his path. They got him started, to understand what meditation is all about. And also, of course, he teaches them because he understands that they have spiritual faculties which are quite strong. So they might be able to understand this profound teaching. But gratitude seems to be the main motivation factor here. Then the Buddha realized that they have both passed away. There's nothing much more he can do for them. So for that reason, he says, okay, cannot start with teaching these people. I have to start somewhere else. And then he asks himself, well, where should I teach in that case? And his next thought is, I should teach my five companions who looked after me before my enlightenment. Why should I do that? Because, again, they were very helpful for me. They supported me before, and that's why I should do something for them. So again, driven by gratitude, that is what drives the Buddha, gratitude and compassion. So the Buddha then decides, okay, I'm going to go off and find out where these people are. He finds out that they are in Benares, which is about 400 kilometers or something from the place of enlightenment. It's a long way to travel. So he sets off walking towards Benares to teach these five disciples, the five supporters who looked after him before. And on the way to Benares, he meets a man whom I cannot remember the name of anyway, but doesn't matter what his name is. And this man sees the Buddha coming on the road. The Buddha obviously has just become enlightened, maybe only a few days or a few weeks before. You can imagine what somebody's like just after enlightenment. They're going to be very kind of powerful. They're going to be very radiant and very special. There's going to be something very unique about them. And of course, this man, he looks at the Buddha and says to the Buddha, you look very radiant. Your skin is very bright. Your faculties are very clear. There seems to be something special about you. Who is your teacher? Now this person, he happens to be in Ajivaka. He's a member of a different sect. He has a different kind of, you know, view to Buddhists. That's an important part of the story here. And so the Buddha says to him, I have no teacher. I have found enlightenment for myself. So how can I say that I have a teacher in the world? I am self-enlightened. And then this Ajivaka man says, well, if that is so, you must be like a conqueror, all-conquering kind of person. Because this apparently was the highest kind of personality in the Ajivaka religion. And the Buddha answered, basically, yes, you know, I have conquered those things which are worthy of conquering in the world, conquering suffering, finding true happiness and peace. And then, of course, here is a man, he's face-to-face with the Buddha. He's face-to-face with the highest possible being in the Buddhist cosmos. Nothing can be higher than the Buddha in terms of wisdom, compassion, and all these beautiful qualities. And yet, when he hears these words, what happens? He shakes his head and he walks off. That's what happens. There's another one shaking his head down there. So you can see how, and what is the reason, what is actually going on here? What is the purpose of this story here? And what this story shows, that even when you meet the Buddha, you meet somebody who is, you know, as perfect as you can be, unless you are ready to see and understand that this person is special, you won't be able to see it. And of course, the reason why he couldn't see it was because he already was probably, he had another religion already. He was already in Ajivaka. So in a sense, he already had a view as to what the highest kind of spiritual being was, the highest kind of thing was. And because of that, he was blocked from being able to see the reality right there in front of him. So he walked off. And the word in Pali, which is used, is a word called umaga. Umaga has a sense of taking the wrong path. And of course, the point is that you had the right path in front of you. You had the Buddha in front of you. You had the chance to doing all the right things. But because you had wrong view, you weren't even able to get started on the Noble Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path starts off with right view, which begins with faith in the Buddha, understanding that the Buddha is enlightened. If you haven't got that faith, basically you haven't got a chance. And you can see that this is so often true in this world as well. If somebody is already committed to a different religion, somebody is committed to something else, often we get questions like, well, how can I teach this person to find that Buddhism actually is the right way? You know, how can I teach a Christian or a Muslim or a Hindu or an atheist or whatever that this actually is the best thing? Generally speaking, it's almost impossible, because once you have that view, once you have established something inside your mind of what is right and what is wrong, it becomes extremely difficult to change that view around, because you have invested into something, you have taken something aboard, you have established this as a foundation often in your life, lots of emotions going into it, and then it's very hard to change around. So that is why it often becomes so difficult. So very often, I think the best way to distribute and get the Buddha's teachings out there is just to make them available to people. And once they are available, then there are some who will pick it up and see, this makes sense, this is a beautiful teaching. And then there will be the vast majority who just walks past and never has any clue that the Buddha was just standing next to them. So that is an interesting story, and it shows the power of wrong view to hinder you, to block you from actually seeing the truth, even when it is right in front of your very eyes. And it's a powerful understanding here. So the Buddha, of course, is not really bothered by such things, because he has all the peace and happiness that he can have anyway. And there's actually another place where the Buddha says that whether people listen to me when I teach, whether they are concerned about the teaching or not, it doesn't make any difference to me as a Buddha. If they just walk off, that's fine with me. If they listen, that's fine. Obviously, if people listen, it's much better, even for the Buddha, but it doesn't cause him any suffering if people don't listen. So then the Buddha walks off and continues on his walk all the way to Benares, present-day Varanasi. And he walks to the five disciples that he had before, who were looking after him. And they are in the deer park in Saranath, which you can still visit today if you go to India. And he sees the five early disciples in the distance. And when they see the Buddha, they sort of make a pact: we're not going to receive the Buddha. Why not? Because he has been backsliding here. He used to be an ascetic, really tough and really doing all the ascetic practices. But now he took solid food. He's actually backsliding, not practicing properly. So we will not support him. That's what they say to each other. But of course the Buddha has changed. His mannerism has changed. He's a different person than what he used to be. He's no longer what he has. There's something about him which is different. So when he comes, they can't stop themselves but receiving him and taking him in. And the Buddha says to them, listen, I have achieved something amazing, remarkable. Listen to the teachings. And of course, initially they are very skeptical. But then the Buddha says, have I ever spoken to you in this way before? And they say, no. And then eventually he was able to win them over to listen to the teachings. And then the marvelous thing happens, that when he teaches the Dhamma to these disciples, one of them sees what the Buddha is teaching. He understands. He becomes a stream enter. He sees the reality that the Buddha himself saw. And at this point, the Buddha rejoices. The Buddha gains happiness because of this happening. And the Buddha exclaims that Kondanya understands, Kondanya understands. Kondanya is the first disciple who understood the Buddha's teachings. And this is powerful, because the whole purpose for the Buddha is to teach the Dhamma, to relieve people of suffering, to bring them to happiness, to bring them to something good in life. That's the whole purpose of the Buddha. So of course he's very keen on seeing that people get away from the suffering in their life and find that true happiness. So for the Buddha to see that here somebody has understood this, well, his purpose now has been vindicated for trying to teach the Dhamma. He did the right thing. He has done what should be done by teaching the Dhamma. Now he knows that this works. This teaching is possible. And later on in the suttas, you will see things like, there is one sutta which talks about the three types of miracle in the world. The Buddha says there's three types of miracle. There's the miracle of psychic powers, where you can fly through the air and go into the ground, all these kind of things. There is the miracle of mind reading, according to Buddhism. But then there is the third miracle, and that is the miracle of instruction. And the miracle of instruction means that when you teach somebody, they can understand it. No matter, even though it is so incredibly profound, people are still able to understand it when you instruct them. And that, according to the Buddha, that is the greatest miracle. The miracle of mind reading and the miracle of psychic powers. Well, if you use those to try to convert people, it will always have a negative side effect, because lots of people not really understand. They will say you're doing magic, you're doing all kinds of tricks. So the Buddha said those things are dangerous. You shouldn't use those to convert people. The real miracle in the world is the miracle of instruction. The fact that people can be instructed in something so profound and they can actually reach understanding in this thing. That is a real miracle. And that miracle started off when Anya Kondanya, as it became known as later on, when he understood this teaching. He was the first person to break through. And once this happens, once somebody breaks through to the Dhamma, then the wheel of the Dhamma is set rolling in the world. The wheel of the Dhamma is the idea that once you start teaching, and once somebody understands, then the Dhamma will almost like propagate itself. Why is that? Because once one person understands, and somebody else will be taught by them. The next generation will be taught by the previous generation. And so it goes on, rolls on through the ages. The Dhamma is something which you cannot stop, because there always will be people who understand and who will practice and who will continue realizing that Dhamma throughout the ages. And that is why the Dhamma is here still today, because the wheel of the Dhamma was set rolling that particular day in the deer park in Saranat in Benares. And nobody has been able, hopefully also not willing, but certainly not able to stop that wheel of the Dhamma from rolling along for 2,500 years. So, of course, this was a magnificent moment when this whole thing started off. This was the beginning of Buddhism in reality. Somebody understood understood this teaching having been taught. That's when Buddhism started. Before that, there was only the enlightenment, and that is not enough. Enlightenment is not sufficient for Buddhism to get started, because you can't be enlightened without teaching. But only when the teaching happens do you have Buddhism. Or should we say the Dhamma? Buddhism is actually a very bad and very kind of all-encompassing word. It means so many things to so many different people. But if you say the Dhamma, or the Buddha's teachings, you might be closer to the mark. What happened next? And what happens next, of course, is the Buddha now knows that he has to teach the Dhamma. This beautiful teaching should be made available to people, because there are people out there who will understand it. So he spends the next 45 years teaching this Dhamma to people, making it available for the happiness and benefit of all beings everywhere around the world. And one of the nice little stories along the way is quite early on when the Buddha, when Venerable Sariputta, his name was Sariputta before he became Venerable Sariputta, and how he got converted, so to speak, to Buddhism is quite an interesting little story. This was very early on in the Buddha's teaching career. After the five ascetics had been converted and become Buddhist, and they were all fully enlightened, they would wander around. They were still based in Rajagaha, in the Magadhan Republic, close to the Ganges River. One day, Venerable Sariputta, who was at that time an ascetic, was practicing under somebody with a very different view, a very different way of practicing, somebody who was a skeptic. These skeptics that said, nothing is acceptable to me, I don't believe in anything. That was basically the view they had. So he was a kind of absolute skeptic. One day, because these skeptics were also monks in a sense, they were wandering around in the streets and collecting alms food and these things. One day when he was collecting alms food, he saw this monk coming along the road. And this monk happened to be Asaji, one of the first five disciples of the Buddha. He sees this monk and he understands there's something special about this monk. I've never ever seen anybody like that before. He is serene, peaceful, calm, collected. There's something about him which is absolutely unique. Surely this monk has found what I desire for myself, what I want. He must have found the deathless. So he goes up to Venerable Asaji, who is an arahat of course, a fully enlightened arahat, and he says, who is your teacher? What teaching does he profess? And Venerable Asaji says that, the Buddha is my teacher, and I am very new to this Dhamma and discipline, so I can't really teach you very much about what the Buddha said. He's an arahat, right? It's quite interesting. He's an arahat, says, I can't really teach you very much, because I'm only new to this Dhamma and discipline. Venerable Sariputta says, never mind, you don't have to teach me in great detail, just give me a teaching in brief. Venerable Asaji says that all things which have a nature to arise also have a nature to cease. That's basically essentially the teaching that he gives to Venerable Sariputta. And what happens when Venerable Sariputta gets this teaching? That's all he's taught, right? This is quite amazing. That's all he's taught, and that's enough for him to become a stream entry. That's enough for him to realize the Dhamma. That is quite amazing. That shows you, of course, again, if you are very ripe, if everything is ready inside of your mind, if you've done all the foundation work in terms of morality and meditation, all you need to hear is one profound line of Dhamma. Everything which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease. That is sufficient for you to make the breakthrough and become a stream entry. There's a very profound little phrase that, and it's difficult to really, you have to really think a lot about it before you even understand what that, what the implications of that are. The implications are basically that everything is suffering, there is no self, everything is impermanent, so you have to let go of everything. That's essentially the implication of that statement. And also it's very beautiful here, you see this 7th monk, Asaji, who is an arahant, he says, well, actually, I don't really know much about this teaching. I'm new to this Dhamma and discipline. It's fascinating. How can an arahant say that? Somebody's fully enlightened. And the reason is because there is a distinction in Buddhism between understanding Dhamma, between enlightenment, and between the ability to teach. Because enlightenment is an insight. And you can be a very simple person and be enlightened. You don't have to be very sophisticated or anything like that. And the other thing is that you, to actually verbalize the teaching, verbalize the insight you have, is very different from actually having the insight in the first place. Because an insight is just like something you see with your mind. It's not a verbalized thing. It's something inside of your mind. So then, afterwards, you have to sit down and think, well, how am I going to teach this teaching here? And that is what, of course, is the difference here. Asaji was new to the Dhamma. He had the full insight, but he did not yet, he hadn't yet kind of verbalized it or understood how to pass it on to other people. And that's why he said, I'm new to this Dhamma discipline. So that is an important thing to think of, because sometimes you can meet monks who are extraordinarily simple people, very, very simple. And yet when you look at them and you see what they're like and the kind of aura they have about them, how peaceful and compassionate and kind they are, you realize that this person is exceptional, they are special. It's important not to judge people by their kind of intellectual abilities and the abilities to teach the Dhamma. That's not really where it's at with the Dhamma. The real measure of the Dhamma is in terms of peace, compassion, kindness, virtue, and wisdom. And wisdom is something very simple often. So I want you to keep that in mind, because sometimes you will find that you meet monks and nuns in the world who are exceptional and really are unique. And yet they may not be, that the Dhamma they teach may be very, very simple. They may say, just relax, take it easy when you watch the breath. And of course what that means is that it means everything. If you can really, really relax while you watch the breath, you're going to see the breath very clearly and you're going into very deep meditation. So that is, I think, is an important point to always keep in mind. And it shows us the danger often of being judgmental. So often it's important to inquire, but at the same time be careful not to judge anything too fast, because it can always lead to a kind of backlash if you do that. What then? So this Sariputta then becomes the stream enter after hearing this very simple line of teaching. Then he goes back to his friend Mahamoggallana, and Mahamoggallana says to his friend Sariputta, something has happened to you. You look different than what you were before. And of course, something has happened. He's become a stream enter. And then when Mahamoggallana asks, well, what actually happened? And Venerable Sariputta says, well, this is what happened to me. This is the teaching I was given. And then he gives the same teaching or a similar teaching to Mahamoggallana. And Venerable Mahamoggallana then also sees the Dhamma, also becomes a stream enter. And then of course later on, these two monks, they ordain, and they become the two chief disciples of the Buddha. Venerable Sariputta being the famous for being the wisest of all the monks apart from the Buddha himself. Venerable Mahamoggallana being famous for his psychic powers in particular. So that is in brief the story of these two monks. I think that's probably enough about them. And then the Buddha keeps on teaching like that for another maybe 40, 45 years, traveling all over India, having compassion for everybody. Whenever he sees somebody who has the potential to gain something, he will go out of his way to teach them in a way so they can gain awakening. Because that is the purpose of the Buddha's teaching. One very nice story was just coming to mind right now is a beautiful story of a man who was a cow herder, and this man, the Buddha realized by reading his mind that this man, he's a cow herder, very simple man, he has the potential to become a stream enter, to attain the full insight into the Buddha's teaching. But then the Buddha sees that this man, because he is a very simple man, he's a cow herder, he's been running around all day after his cows, he has lost some of his cows, so he's completely exhausted, he hasn't eaten all day, And he, because of that, he is really totally exhausted. So then the Buddha, Buddha, of course, because he realized he has this ability for stream entry, when this cowherd comes up to him and says, oh, you know, please teach the Dhamma, the Buddha says, go and have a good meal first of all. So then, of course, the man, he goes and has a good meal. And then when he comes back to the Buddha to listen to the Dhamma, of course, then he attains that stream entry and understands the Dhamma in the right way. And of course, the point of this story is not so much that the Buddha gave the man a meal. That's not so much the point. The point, the reason why this story is so touching is because the Buddha wanted this man to become enlightened, wanted him to attain stream entry. And he realized that unless he had a good meal, first of all, he would not be able to attain that stream entry. If you're so preoccupied with hunger, so preoccupied with your own weakness, you cannot actually focus on the Dhamma enough to be able to allow it to go in. And that is the real compassion in that story here. Everything is about understanding the Dhamma. It is not so much about just having a nice meal. So then, this is the kind of teaching which then goes on and on and on for 45 years. And then we come towards the end of the Buddha's life, towards the final days, and this is the famous story found in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, when the Buddha wanders from Rajagaha all the way to Kushinagara, where he passes away. And there's lots of interesting little things which happen on this way there to Kushinagara. And one of the interesting things is that because the Buddha knows that these are his last days, he lays down a way for deciding, well, what are the teachings of the Buddha and what are not the teachings of Buddha? How should we decide in posteriority what the Buddha actually taught? And what he says is that those teachings which are the same or similar, which other people say that I taught, in other words, the Buddha taught, those teachings are the same and similar to what I taught before, those teachings you can accept as my word. So this is how we decide. We go to the point of asking ourselves, is a particular teaching similar to what we know the Buddha taught? If it is, then it's acceptable. If it isn't, it's not acceptable. But the Buddha also said something else which is very fascinating. He said in a particular place in the Anguttara Nikaya, one of the suttas, he says that there will be a time in the future when the Dhamma goes downhill. Dhamma is disappearing in the world. And there are these particular five reasons for why the Dhamma is disappearing. And one of those reasons that the Buddha said for the disappearance of the Dhamma in the world is that people will no longer pay attention to those suttas that were spoken by the Buddha, but that are profound, connected with emptiness. They will no longer listen to that. And instead, they will listen to suttas or things spoken by disciples of the Buddha instead, and by all other kind of people, even outside of Buddhism, such as poets and all kind of things. And it's a very important statement by the Buddha, because what this means is that for the real inspiration in the Dhamma, and for checking out what is the real Dhamma, we're going to have to go back to the word of the Buddha. That is the only source of authority that we have. Anybody apart from the Buddha is considered a savaka, a disciple of the Buddha. And the Buddha says here directly that this is not where you should find your final inspiration. The ultimate inspiration should come from the Buddha himself. And it's so obvious when you think about it why that is. The reason is simply that the Buddha must have been enlightened. Because if the Buddha wasn't enlightened, then there is no Buddhism. The whole thing collapses. But everybody else apart from the Buddha, we don't know whether enlightened or not. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. Maybe they were wise, maybe they were not wise. But ultimately, it's the word of the Buddha, which is the only authority that we have to rely on 100%. Everything else is uncertain. So that is why it is so important to always to be honest and look squarely at it. Find out what did the Buddha actually say and what didn't he say. What are the words of disciples? And of course, that includes all modern day monks and nuns and anybody. We are all disciples. And the word of anybody in the modern day does not count beside the word of the Buddha. So even what I'm saying now, you can argue, well, you don't really know. Check it out for yourself. Did the Buddha actually say what I'm saying he said? And then believe it when you see it on black and white. So So that is one of the wonderful teachings that he gave, and which actually have so much implication, so incredibly profound implications when you think about it, in terms of how we investigate the Dhamma and what we take to be the real teachings. Extremely, extremely important. And then the Buddha also says that, I have no teacher's fist. There is no inner and outer in the Buddha's dispensation. And what this means, that there is no teacher's fist, means that there is no kind of secrets which have been held back from the Sangha. The teachings are out there in the open for everybody to see. And there is no inner and outer. There is no inner circle of disciples who have been given special instructions, and then a kind of outer disciples are not so important who have been given lesser instructions. It doesn't work like that in Buddhism. The Dhamma is available to everybody in equal measure. If you want it, you can have it. And that, of course, why is that? Well, it is simply because the Dhamma is for compassion, is for helping people overcoming suffering. So why should it not be available to everybody when it's only taught for the ending of suffering, for the happiness of everybody? It should be available to everybody. Anything else is senseless. It doesn't make any sense. Well, this is one of the hallmarks, one of the beautiful hallmarks of the Buddha's, the true Buddhist teaching, that it is open and available to everybody. There is no distinction between different types of people. And then the Buddha's last journey continues. He continues traveling towards Kushinagara, where he's going to attain his final parinibbana. And then towards the very end of his life, there are some more interesting stories which I personally always enjoy. I talk about these stories every time I'm here at the Vesak, but for me they are so nice that I always get inspired by these things, no matter how many times I hear it. And one of those stories is when the Buddha is lying on his deathbed. He's just about to pass away, and everybody's coming to pay respects to him, and some beings are crying and some beings are not crying because they're arahants. There's all kinds of people and devatas and all kinds of things there. And then a man comes along, and he has just recently heard that there is a Buddha in the world, and not only that, but that Buddha is about to pass away. So he thinks, oh, I better go and check it out very quickly, because this might be my last chance. So he goes to Venerable Ananda, who is the Buddha's attendant, and he says to Venerable Ananda, I have a question to ask from the Buddha. Can you please make an opportunity for me so I can put my question to him? And Venerable Ananda says, and this obviously would make sense in the circumstances, he says, this is the wrong time to bother the Buddha. He's on his deathbed. He's just about to pass away. You can see why he would say that. Normally you don't want to bother anybody when they're on the deathbed. You've got a few hours left. But of course the Buddha is not just anybody else. And as I mentioned before, the whole purpose of the Buddha's life is compassion, is teaching the Dhamma, showing people, helping people out. And that, of course, is the purpose of his life until he draws his very last breath. So he realizes what is going on, and he says to Venerable Ananda, please allow him to come through, because this is a seeker of truth. He's not come just to bother me, to argue with me, and to make life difficult for me. He's actually really interested in the Dhamma. So this man is allowed to come forward and then ask the Buddha the question. And the question that he asked the Buddha is as follows. There's all these teachers out there who teach different paths, different ways, and they all claim to be enlightened. And there's a whole list of teachers mentioned in this particular sutta. And he says to the Buddha, well, which of them is enlightened and which is not? Good question, isn't it? It's the kind of question we all would like to know, because we can never be sure about these things. And the Buddha answers, the Buddha doesn't say this one is not enlightened, this one is a little bit enlightened. The Buddha says that, forget about that. Forget about the whole thing, who is enlightened or not. All you need to know is that wherever somebody practices the Noble Eightfold Path, that is where you're going to find enlightened beings. If you don't practice the Eightfold Path, you're not going to find enlightened beings. That's all he says there. And of course, it's a beautiful example for us. When we think about it, it doesn't matter. There's no need to go around judging people of other religions. No reason to go around saying that they are doing the wrong thing or not. All that matters is whether they're practicing rightly or wrongly. That is what matters in the world. And you will find that there are people of other religions who are practicing maybe something which approximates, gets closer to the Noble Eightfold Path. They're never going to be able to practice 100% because there's a certain amount of wrong view there, but they may practice it close enough that it actually has, that they're actually doing the right thing, at least to a certain extent. And to that extent, it doesn't matter which religion you are, to that extent, they are also doing the right thing, what is good. And that is the beautiful aspect, of course, of Buddhism, is that it's what you do is usually more important than what you believe. This is what ultimately what it comes down to. Of course, what you believe is going to have an influence on what you do, so it's not completely irrelevant. But what you do is the final kind of standard we have to use to decide whether people are doing the right thing or not. And of course, this man who gets this teaching, he understands what the Buddha says, and he becomes a stream mentor. He's the last person to become the Buddha's disciple fully. So then time goes by, and then there is another monk who goes to the Buddha, and he goes to the Buddha and he says, Master, there is this other monk. This is actually not in the suttas, so maybe I shouldn't say this story. This is somewhere else in the commentarial works. I'm really contradicting myself here. I say only to read the suttas, and now I'm actually quoting from somewhere else. But it's a beautiful story, and it sort of encompasses the spirit of Buddhism. So I think it's a nice one anyway. And this is the story of a monk who goes to him and says, Master, there is a monk who's refusing to come and pay respects to you. You're on your deathbed, you're dying here. Everybody should come and pay respect. Why isn't it this monk doing his duty? And then the Buddha says to him that, what does he do then if he doesn't pay respect to me? He's just sitting in the forest meditating and practicing. And the Buddha says, good on him, he is doing the right thing. This is the way that you should, if you want to worship the Buddha, if you want to bow down to the Buddha, this is the right way of doing it. By practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, practicing meditation, and getting that understanding and wisdom which the Buddha himself taught everybody. And even though that is not actually in the suttas, it is a kind of teaching which matches perfectly with other things the Buddha said. So I think it is, even if it isn't strictly true, it certainly is, in my opinion anyway, a correct type of teaching. Because that was what the Buddha was concerned about. He was concerned about real results, real kind of wisdom and insight, real ending of suffering in life. And then, of course, the night goes on, and the Buddha gets closer and closer to his final passing away. And then you get to the last words of the Buddha, where the Buddha says to his disciples, all conditioned phenomena have the nature to cease or to end or to come to an end. Strive on with diligence. And this is a beautiful teaching because in a sense it summarizes the entire Buddha's teaching in two little sentences. All compounded things have the nature to cease, vaya, which means like to cease basically. This means that because everything has a nature to cease, everything is suffering here. Because everything is impermanent and passing away all the time, it's non-self. So here you have a very compact statement of the entire teaching of the Buddha in two little words. And then the other part of the teaching is strive on with diligence. It shows you first the suffering, the problem in the world, and then it shows you the solution. The solution is to practice in the right way, the striving on with diligence. So the Buddha there is summarizing his whole teaching in two tiny little sentences. And then the Buddha passes away. Parinibbana ceases to exist completely. And that very fact that the Buddha ceases to exist, he passes into Parinibbana. Well, first of all, before I say anything about that, first of all, the interesting question is, well, is that a good thing or bad thing that the Buddha passed away here? And the interesting thing is that, of course, for the Buddha himself, it's good, because he was now rid of the body, he was getting old, he was getting pains, and this is something which is stated in many places in the suttas. So the Buddha himself was obviously quite content to pass away. And all the people who were enlightened, who realized that these things have to happen, this is one of the consequences of enlightenment, that you understand that things are impermanent and have to pass away. All those beings were not so bothered by the Buddha passing away, because they already knew that this was bound to happen. But of course, everybody else who were not enlightened, they were the ones who were crying. They are the ones who were sad, because they were saying the eye of the world has disappeared too soon. The Buddha is the eye of the world because he sees, right? He understands. He sees the reality which we are not able to see. So he's like, he sees on our behalf, so to speak. Yeah? And they're all crying and wailing because the Buddha is passing away here. Yeah? And maybe some of them are crying because they hadn't practiced hard enough. They realized that they had wasted an opportunity here. And that, of course, is a very good reason for being sad, in a sense, because once it's finished, it is too late. And it's important to realize that this is also a simile for Buddhism as a whole. The Buddha passing away is one thing, but Buddhism as a whole is also going to pass away. Buddhism as a religion is an impermanent thing. It's something which arises, it was very, very strong soon after the Buddha for a few centuries, and then it started to decline. And the last 2,000 years, at least, has been just a steady period of decline for Buddhism. And once we understand this impermanence of Buddhism, once we understand that one day there won't be any Buddhism anymore, it gives us a sense of urgency again. This is a rare opportunity for this practice. The Buddha's death is a timely reminder for us that these things are impermanent. If the Buddha is impermanent, his teachings are certainly also impermanent. So bring that, take that into your heart and remember that, because the Buddha himself said that the arising of a Buddha in the world and the arising of the teachings for people to hear, it's so rare in the world, it's so difficult to find. And now you have the opportunity. You never know when that opportunity will come up again in the future. And don't think that, oh, I'll just hang out and chill out till the Buddha Maitreya comes around, because then there will be another Buddha in the world. Now that is a dangerous way of thinking, because Buddha Maitreya is another of these legends, another of these myths that people talk about. There will be some kind of Buddha in the future. And no doubt there will be a Buddha in the future. I don't have any doubt about that, because Buddhas arise every now and again. But we don't know when it's going to be. We don't know whether we will be there. We don't know if we will be intelligent enough to understand the message. Basically, the uncertainties are just enormous, absolutely staggering. And because of that, don't wait for the Buddha Maitreya or for any other Buddha. This is the time. Now we have the teachings. They are here right and now. This is the time to do the practice, not to put it off. And if you want that for your long-lasting happiness and benefit for yourself, and also for all your relatives and everybody else who you touch in your life, then that is the right way to go about it. Okay.
Thank you very much, Ajahn Brahmali, for reminding us the urgency of practice. Perhaps I could start off with the first question is, how did this concept of Maitreya Buddha come about, and is it being promoted in the right way, or is it really helping, causing people to put off their urgency of practice?
Yeah, the reason why this concept of Maitreya Buddha come around is one sutta in the Digha Nikaya, which mentions the future Buddha, calls him the Maitreya Buddha. There's only one sutta. And this sutta is a kind of legendary, mythical style of sutta. And I personally have no idea. I think the general idea that there will be a Buddha in the future is obviously a sound one. But to actually pinpoint that there is a particular Buddha, his name is Maitreya, and he will arise at such and such a time, that's when the complications get in there. Because this one mythical sutta is not enough for you to decide that there is such a thing as Maitreya Buddha in the future. It's not sufficient. It's just it has to remain in the realm of legend and mythology. So that is why it is dangerous. But of course, what happens in Buddhism and happens in all kinds of religions, people take one little statement in one sutta and they blow it out of complete proportions. And you find there's a book in the Pali, late Pali, it's called the Anagatavamsa. Anagatavamsa means the lineage of the future. And this is like, the idea is that it talks about the lineage of Buddhas in the future. So that is, of course, comes from this idea of Maitreya, of a Buddha, and then it gets blown out of all proportions, and the actual worship becomes of the future Buddhas rather than the present Buddha. But it's very easy, because we can know with almost absolute certainty that this Anagatavamsa, the lineage of the future, was never spoken by the Buddha. It is a much later kind of idea. So because of that, using the things I said before, the ideas of what is the word of the Buddha, what is really important to listen to, we can just set it to one side. We don't have to worry about this lineage of the future Buddhas. And yes, it leads to all kinds of problems. Once you decide that there is such a thing as Maitreya Buddha, you start to worship this Buddha, because you start to think that okay, that's better, that's easier to concentrate. Okay. So it leads to all kinds of problems, because people start to worship this Buddha as if he is the one who is teaching us, as if he is the one who gives us some kind of comfort. It's not. Our teacher is Gautama Buddha. He is our teacher. Maitreya Buddha is just a figment of our imagination. So basically, I would say, forget about Maitreya Buddha. Sometimes we have people who start massive projects, building Buddha statues out of Maitreya Buddha. Actually, Buddha statue is the wrong word. It's not even a Buddha yet. Building statues out of this Maitreya, enormous statues. I recently went to Java in Indonesia myself. And I went there, and I went into one ancient temple which is 1,000 years old in Java, because they have a very ancient Buddhism over there. And of course I went into the temple, there was a massive statue of Maitreya Buddha. That's what I saw in this temple. It started a long, long, long time ago, this worship of the future Buddha. There wasn't even an ordinary Buddha there. The main shrine was only Maitreya Buddha. And this is happening to the present day. You find people building enormous statues of Maitreya Buddha. And it is basically, in my opinion, it is the wrong way of practicing Buddhism. This is not Buddhism. This is some kind of cult worship or something like that. It's the wrong way to do it. That's just my opinion. I don't want to offend anybody. That's the way I personally look at it.
Hi, Ajahn Brahmali. One question I had when I was listening to your talk is, you mentioned that after the Buddha attained enlightenment, his first inclination was not to teach. But later on, he decided, out of compassion, that he would share the teachings with the world. Just wanted to ask very briefly, this compassion that arose, is it a result of his own personal nature, or is it something that came up from his enlightenment? So if for example, if it was someone else who attained enlightenment and he didn't have this compassion, does that mean that we wouldn't have Buddhism? Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, no, it's part of the enlightenment experience. It's part of actually becoming enlightened. Because remember, the whole purpose of becoming enlightened is finding the end of suffering, right? So if you understand that the human nature is to suffer, and you look around, you see all the suffering beings around you, and you know that you also have found the solution to the problem, then compassion comes automatically. It's part of the nature of being a Buddha. So this would come to all kind of Buddhas. But it's interesting, because that compassion didn't really have a chance to express itself until he saw that people would understand the teachings. Before he saw that, there was no point in teaching somebody who won't understand. So he might still be compassionate, but there's no point in expressing that if nobody will understand it. And that's why you have this idea of Pacheka Buddhas in the world. Pacheka Buddha is like a private Buddha, somebody who gains full enlightenment by themselves, but they don't teach. And that is presumably because nobody says to them, well, listen, you know, there are all these beings out there who suffer, and they will understand your teachings. So if the Brahma Sahampati, or I'm not 100% sure whether that is a true teaching. I know what Ajahn Brahm seems to think so, and he's wiser than me, so you should listen to him rather than me. But it might be that if nobody came to the Buddha and said, you know, please teach, he might have been a Pacheka Buddha, just like all the Pacheka Buddhas. Yeah.
Ajahn Brahmali, perhaps you could explain the, you know, when Gautama became a Buddha, that he didn't have the sense of will, rather than the lacking of compassion to teach, which sometimes when we hear this teaching, that, oh, so Gautama wasn't a very compassionate person, because he really didn't start off wanting to teach, but because Brahma Sahampati came down to request,
yeah,
which created that will.
Yeah, it's precisely, and that is precisely the point. The point is basically just that how can you arouse the will to teach if you don't think anybody will understand you? There's no point in teaching in that case. So the will cannot arise. The will has to arise only when you understand that there will be some benefit of that teaching. There's no point in teaching if there is no benefit in it. So somebody has to rouse that, rouse the Buddha to say, well, actually, there is the potential here for understanding. So if you teach, people will benefit. So of course, the inclination of the Buddha will be to be passive, because that passivity is for him happiness. It's just like in our meditation, the more we think and the more will we have going on, the more suffering it is. And it is exactly the same for the Buddha. It is the activity of the mind is not just suffering because we are unenlightened, it's inherently suffering. Of course, I should add very quickly here that the type of suffering a Buddha has is tiny, 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 tiny compared to what we have. He has done away with 99.9% of the suffering that we have as ordinary beings. Take away the craving, take away the attachment, and almost everything is taken away here. There's a small remainder left. And that small remainder is just the functioning of the mind, the functioning of the body. That itself, by its very nature, is painful. And having a will, having a consciousness, all these things are painful by their very nature. So, of course, the Buddha is not going to start arousing that will unless it is absolutely necessary. Because for him also, there is a small element of suffering involved.
It's on the same problem about the Buddha's inclination not to teach. I think the commentaries say that the Buddha was simply waiting for Brahma Sahampati to invite him to teach, because he said that was the custom of all Buddhas in the past. I mean, is it implicit in that sutta itself?
Not implicit at all. It's the other way around. Implicit in the sutta, the Buddha says, my mind did not incline to teach because I couldn't see anybody becoming awakened. So if the commentary is right, the Buddha would practically be lying. Because what he says is opposite of what the commentary is saying here. So I think the commentarian idea here is it's almost disproved straight away, because it's directly contrary to what the sutta says. That is why we have to be careful again with the commentaries. Because sometimes they say things, sometimes they can be useful, but occasionally at least they say things which are very, are basically contradicted by the sutta. Yeah, you have to be careful, because the intentions are good, obviously, right? So we have to remember that all these commentators, they were doing their best to try to explain the Dhamma. But essentially, they were not enlightened people, very unlikely to be enlightened people. So they didn't really know what they were talking about. So they were bound to make some mistakes.
Then there's the other problem in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where the Buddha hinted three times to Ananda that if he so desired, he could extend his life up to the end of the aeon. But when Ananda did not catch the hint, the Buddha then relinquished his life force. I mean, there's a problem of compassion there. Why did the Buddha then not decide to extend his life?
Yeah, it's a very strange story. And the story gets even worse later on, because later on he goes to Chunda's house, he eats meat, and then he dies from the meat. So did he die because he relinquished life faculty, or because he had the meat? There is there are lots of problems with that sutta. And I read a very interesting study by an Austrian scholar called Frauwallner, who is very famous, particularly a book he wrote, which is, I can't remember its name, it's about the Vinaya basically, but it also goes into the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And he dissects the Mahaparinibbana Sutta in many different ways. And essentially he shows that the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is a late compilation. It's not really an original discourse made by the Buddha. And if you read that sutta, you can see that it is compiled of many small aspects put together into this enormous narrative. It's the longest sutta by far in the Digha Nikaya, covers over 60 pages, I think, in the Pali. It's absolutely enormous. There's nothing else like it. And it's not a continuous narrative. It has a sense of compilation. And if you compare it, and this is also one of the classical ways of finding out what is original and what is not, if you compare it to the other Mahaparinibbana Suttas, there are Mahaparinibbana Suttas certainly in Chinese, and there is also at least fragments existing still in Sanskrit. And comparative studies, often bear that out, that there is discrepancies between these suttas. And I personally, I find that whole story with the Ananda kind of asking the Buddha, and the Buddha saying that, well, you know, why didn't you ask me properly? And then it turns out Mara was in Ananda's mind. I mean, the whole thing just sounds so improbable to me, and so unlikely that I am inclined to think that the whole thing is just quite possibly is not actually what actually happened at the time of the Buddha. I think it is much more likely that what happened was that the Buddha just ate. He had some meat at the Chunda's house, which was not right, which wasn't good. And then he died, basically, of the natural causes from that. He knew that his end was near anyway. And that was actually the final cause of his death. That's what I think. And I'm skeptical about that whole story. And it's not just my personal skepticism. There are good scholarly reasons for being skeptical as well. That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay, Ajahn, there's a question from downstairs through SMS. Just now you mentioned there are four things that Buddha said will lead to the end of Buddhism. You mentioned want. I think there are five things. You mentioned one. Where are the other four?
Boy, this is really asking tough questions. There are actually many, many, many suttas which talk about what leads to the destruction and downgrading of Buddha. Lots of suttas. And you find them mostly in the Anguttara Nikaya. So what I can say, I cannot remember now precisely what this particular sutta says are things which calls the decline of Buddhism. I cannot actually distinguish the different suttas in my mind that clearly. But what I can say, I can give you some general ideas. What are the things which cause decline in Buddhism, more generally speaking? And this is actually quite fascinating because this is a kind of argument which I have used before when I have, sometimes I argue with other people, with other monks about various kind of matters. Not really a friendly argument, of course. The kind of thing which leads to the decline of Buddhism, of course, is if people lose respect for the Buddha. That is a classical case of decline of Buddhism. If you lose respect for the Buddha, then you don't have the faith in this foundation stone of what Buddhism is all about. Don't have faith in that foundation stone, the whole thing falls apart. Another one is losing respect, being disrespectful towards the Dhamma. Again, the Dhamma is the teaching of the Buddha. Don't have respect for that. Well, in essence, you also don't have respect for the Buddha. Another one is losing respect for the Sangha. Sangha is the Arya Sangha, the noble ones. They are the ones who practice the path and show us that it is possible to get enlightenment by practicing the Buddhist path. The fourth one is not having respect for the training, the Sikha. In other words, knowing what the Dhamma is, but not then training appropriately according to that Dhamma. Not respecting it, sort of maybe looking down upon it or whatever is required. And then there is an interesting one which always caught my eye when I was reading this. And that is, the fifth one was having disrespect for samadhi, for concentration. Very, very interesting. Because one of the interesting things when you know a little bit about the history of Buddhism is that the idea of the importance of samadhi and concentration and deep meditation in Buddhism, it is so powerfully explained in the suttas. It's very, very powerful. It's very easy to make an argument from the suttas that this is absolutely required for you to become enlightened, for you to gain any kind of wisdom whatsoever. And yet, then when you start to read the commentaries, they start to say things like, it's not, you know, not everywhere, but certain places say it's not so important. You can gain these things without samadhi, without jhana, without right concentration. And then you go, the further you move along in history, you come to the point, like for example, sometimes even recently, when people say things like, actually, not only shouldn't you do samadhi, you should be careful about samadhi because you can get attached to it. So the best thing maybe not to do it. So this is the kind of inversion of the Buddha's teaching. You turn it absolutely upside down on its head, and you create a completely new religion, got nothing to do with the original teachings anymore. And that is the danger. And suddenly when I read this sutta, and here the Buddha says that one of the future dangers of Buddhism is disrespect for samadhi, I thought, wow, this is really prescient. This was said 2,500 years ago by the Buddha. He obviously understood that there is a tendency in the human mind not to take the samadhi so seriously. Why is that tendency? Well, I think the reason may be that samadhi is something that you have to be very diligent and persistent and keep practicing to achieve. It's not easy. And because human beings, we always want the easy way out. Of course we want. I mean, that's obvious. We don't want to suffer, right? This is what Buddhism is all about. So because of that, we tend to, well, maybe there is another way. Maybe we can just do, other things instead. But you can see the danger there. What actually happens, rather than actually getting the results by doing something else, you lose your ability to get the results altogether instead. And that is the danger with this kind of rationale, this kind of thinking. So those are some of the reasons why Buddhism declined. There's also more said in that in some of those suttas. For example, I think there is, what else are there? When people are not courteous to each other, or sangha not courteous to each other, is one of them. This is a lesser one, does not occur that often. But the five main ones are the five ones I just mentioned just before. I cannot remember any more. I'm sure there is more in there somewhere.
Ajahn Brahmali, what about the point about because the Buddha ordained women, that it's supposed to decrease the sasana for 500 years? I mean, what's your comment on that based on your scholastic studies?
No, I'm joking. I'm exaggerating. It's not that. It's not that bad. It's not that. It is certainly controversial, very controversial topic. Yeah. And in most countries, of course, they will say that this is the teaching of the Buddha. And I think nobody is absolutely sure where this actually comes from. And really, the person who should ask is Ajahn Sujato, because this is his area of expertise. He's very involved with bhikkhuni ordination. He's extremely pro bhikkhuni ordination. And he's supporting, I think, lots of women all the way around the world towards bhikkhuni ordination. And he has covered this area in massive detail. He knows exactly what's going on. But there are some very interesting contradictions in the suttas. For example, there's one place where it is said that, where the Buddha is said to have said that the sasana, the dispensation of the Buddha, will not be complete until you have a bhikkhu sangha, a bhikkhuni sangha, lay men and lay women. Now, the fourfold assembly, right? So, of course, if he said that, then it's very strange that he should have been reluctant to ordain bhikkhunis in the first place. So you certainly wonder about these kind of things. But sometimes when I think about it, is it possible that ordaining women could have led to a shorter? What would the causes have been? And I think the sort of thing which are dangerous with having men and women ordained together, if it leads to closer association between men and women, well, that would be the sort of thing which have led to the decline. It's got nothing to do with the women, it's just got to do with the nature of what happens when you've got men and women together. And that is the problem, I think. And I think that if I had not, personally, I'm also very pro bhikkhuni ordination. I think it's a great idea, and I think we should certainly have bhikkhunis again in the world. But I think we should live in separate monasteries. Bhikkhunis should live one place, and monks should live somewhere else. Otherwise, you are setting a foundation for all kinds of problems if you don't do it that way. And Ajahn Brahm told me that when he went to, they had this kind of meeting at Santi Monastery, where Ajahn Sujato is the abbot, which was basically to explore the possibilities of bhikkhuni ordination, the problems and whatever. And there was a bhikkhuni from Taiwan there who was invited by Ajahn Sujato because he knows everything was going on in bhikkhunis around the world. And she said that, well, for goodness sake, let us not put men and women together here. Because in Taiwan, we have exactly the same problem. All the best monks and the best nuns end up getting married. And that is precisely what we want to avoid. We don't want to have this, because that is precisely where the destruction of Buddhism comes into the picture.
Good afternoon, Ajahn Brahmali, and happy Visak Day. My question to you is what I promised you 2 days back, the meditation question, so I have to make good that promise. It's relating to Samatha and Vipassana meditation. Okay, how I see the mind works is, if I use an analogy of a pool, I always feel that most of us, the mind works like it's stirred up the pool. So we can't really see it right deep within. So we have to let it settle down so the dust particle actually fell and you can see things as it is. You mentioned about doing death meditation for those who are ready. and he mentioned about Vipassana meditation on the three universal characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta, meaning impermanence, suffering, and non-self. So my question is, when we do this kind of meditation, do we veil our mind or do we condition our mind towards thinking of these three universal characteristics or death, or do we just let the mind really settle down and then see what we see from there? So do we have to direct our mind or just let it be peace and calm?
Usually you have to direct your mind, because unless you are extraordinarily wise and you have extremely deep meditation, you're going to have to direct the mind, because the mind will not go there by itself. If it goes by itself, great, but usually you find that's not enough. And the good thing about the death contemplation is that it sort of unifies the contemplations of anicca, dukkha, anatta in one single contemplation. That is what's so nice about it. And it is a kind of thing which is so personal, so related to yourself. When you think about death, always think of your own death. And I have found in my own practice that when I do that, and it works, it actually can be very quick in giving results, because suddenly all the attachments in the world, all the ill will, it sort of doesn't make any sense anymore in the face of death.
A follow-up question, Ajahn. Thanks for answering. A follow-up question is, do we then direct our mind at a point when we feel so peaceful, and then you feel that there's a tranquility, and then you direct your mind towards that? Or do you do it, you know, right from the onset?
You can do either way. There is no kind of fixed sequence or fixed way you have to do these things. You have to do what works best. At the end of the day, is what works, which really is important. So, for example, if you sit down, you want to watch your breath, or you want to do metta practice, but you are not able to focus your mind because you're very restless or very upset or something inside the mind, very agitated. Because of all that, you cannot focus, and you have to try something else. And that is the time to try something like death meditation to settle the mind down. And it may work. It may not work, but it can work. So you have to try various techniques, various things which may be able to work for you. And then you have a spectrum of different types of meditations. And you can choose like a smorgasbord of meditations, like this choice, this menu in a sense. And after a while you get to know your own mind a little bit better. You start to know what you should be doing at whatever time. And then if you have like success with the death meditation, well then you can go back afterwards and watch the breath or do metta. Because then the success will make your mind peaceful. And then once you have the peace in the mind, then you can watch the breath much more easily again. So experiment a little bit. See what works for you. Nobody has, we're all a little bit different. We all have our strong areas and our weak areas. See what happens.
Okay, thank you, Ajahn. Thanks.
Ajahn, you've obviously come from a theist background, being born in Norway and growing up in probably a very Christian environment. So, no, not at all? Oh, okay. But exposed to theism. What's your view in terms of, perhaps you could tell us some of your background then, in terms of how you came in touch with Buddhism, and what were you educated in terms of religion before you chose this path?
Well, I was basically uneducated in religion. I was completely ignorant. That's basically the truth. My parents were not religious. They're kind of people who go to church once a year at Christmas, because that was what you do. And I was baptized and all that, because that's what you do in a country like Norway, you get baptized. But my parents were essentially what you call agnostics. They were nothing, basically. Neither atheists nor anything. Just completely unknowing. So for me, it was quite easy, because that's probably part of my good karma from the past, that I wasn't brought up as a Christian. Because it made it possible for me, it made a step to become a Buddhist quite easy. I didn't actually have to sort of give anything up. All I had to do was to acquire something. My parents were, in that sense, was very easy with my parents as well, because they weren't really so concerned about those issues. What exactly did you want to ask? Was there anything else? Or?
Yeah, Ajahn, given that many people are brought up with this God-centered universe, so to speak. And in Buddhism, it talks about gods as in just another realm. In fact, a god came down to ask the Buddha to teach. So there's a good expression to say, thank God for Buddhism, right? Because Brahma Sahampati was the god who came down from the god's realm. But what do you think was the causes of why people have this great need for God or gods in their lives? Because every time when something goes right, oh, thank God, or thank some bodhisattva,
yeah,
rather than understanding the cause.
Sure, yeah. That's a very good question. I was speaking with this with Mr. Yap the other day when he drove me back, yeah. And that was very, had a nice conversation. And what I have noticed in my life is that not only is there this idea of God in Christianity and Islam and Hinduism and most religions, but in Buddhism we almost also have, as you say, we have gods. If you look around the world, if you look at the way Buddhism is practiced in almost all Buddhist countries, whether it's Thailand or Burma or China or Korea or wherever you go, a lot of them practice as if the Buddha is a god. And it's fascinating because we come from a religion where there wasn't any god originally, and we have created this god along the way. So I think that the point there seems to be that there seems to be a very profound yearning in the human heart to have some kind of father figure or mother figure, somebody who can protect you and look after you. Because the Buddhist religion can seem so cold to people, so harsh. You are responsible for yourself, it's your life, you've got to do the right thing. You know, it's tough in a sense, you know, you've got to be, it's almost like you have to be psychologically quite together before you can even accept a religion like Buddhism. So that would be my guess, that people need something in their lives to stabilize them. And usually the turning to religion is very often, I think, it comes from that need for something, and something that you can actually support you and give you something. Yeah. But of course, ultimately, if you are going to be wise about it, in my opinion, then of course, taking responsibility for yourself is so much more satisfactory, than relying on something which ultimately you can never even know whether it actually exists. So, do you want to add anything to that?
So for those who are not ready to take responsibility, is it all right then to, have middle hangers, like they have whatever, Kuan Yin or whatever they want to call it, Tara, before they decide that, okay, they can just do this on their own? Or do you think that we should be brave and courageous and just rely on the teachings of the Buddha and aim to take full responsibility for whatever our outcome is?
I don't think it's not a matter of choice, really. Yeah. It's not something that we can say one way or the other. It's just a matter of making the real Buddhist teachings available. Those who are ready will take them up. Those who are not won't take them up. It's really as simple as that. And I would say that, you know, if people are not ready to take up Buddhism, and it might make them they find a lot of psychological comfort, for example, in Kuan Yin or the Christian God or whatever, if that gives them a lot of psychological comfort, well, then good, you know, fine, that's okay. Yeah. And then when they maybe feel psychologically more together, you can present them with the Buddha's teachings. And if they then find it nice, they will turn around. I mean, one of the nice things about Singapore, you now have about, I think, 43, that was in the year 2000, 43% Buddhists. But Christianity is not very deep in Singapore. I think it's quite easy for people to turn people around back to Buddhism again. It's not something very profound in Singaporean culture, because you come from a culture which is much closer to Buddhism than anything else. And that is a good thing, because it means that there is even though people take on Christianity, maybe because they are, I've heard about people taking it on because they're depressed or sad and all these kind of things, because it's a good support network or whatever. It means that once that problem is solved, they can come back to Buddhism again quite easily, because that is very much part of the Singaporean culture. Much more difficult in the West, where Christianity is so much more deeply ingrained in the culture. Actually, it's actually not quite true either. It really depends where you go. For example, if you go to my own home country of Norway, I'll tell you a very interesting statistic, which Ajahn Brahm is the one who actually alerted me to. And he told me that in Sweden, which is the neighboring country of Norway, he said that they had asked school children, if you have to choose a religion, what would you choose? And these were school children about 15 or 16 years old. In Sweden, 90% of the population is atheist, apparently. Christianity is all completely given up. People don't have a religion anymore. But if you have to choose a religion, what would you be? 60%, 60, said that they would choose Buddhism if they had to choose any religion. Now, that is a Western country. So that is how strong Christianity is in certain Western countries. It's very, very weak these days. The main hangout for Christianity now is the United States. In Europe, Christianity is going down, or has at least until now been going down very, very fast. So I shouldn't really say that. In fact, I think that one of the reasons that I might one day take up the idea of becoming an abbot in a monastery in Norway would be precisely because I realize that people there don't have a religion anymore. All they have is materialism, and I think they're open for something profound, something which is a sensible, something which can help them in their lives. I think they're probably open for that. So I think the potential for Buddhism actually probably is reasonably good. As long as you can get over that strangeness factor, it being something strange and different, get beyond that, get to the core of things, I think there is probably a lot of potential there. They're trying to.
Ajahn, I'd like to just follow up on Angie's point regarding responsibility, and it's tied to the question of karma. I think the Buddha taught that all karma has its results, but what I'm interested in is everything we experience the result of karma? Because there's a sutta, the Sivaka Sutta, where the Buddha actually says that, you know, it's not everything which is the result of karma, and he talked to biological causes and possibly maybe even physical laws at work. I mean, what is your view about this?
Precisely, that's a good one. That I know exactly the sutta you're talking about. And the point is that karma, the main purpose of karma, is to explain rebirth. That's the main reason. It's not to explain everything we feel, or everything we perceive, or everything we experience. The main purpose of it is to have an explanatory principle which explains rebirth. That's the main thing. Yeah. So the thing about karma is that if you have a certain amount of karma, you get reborn as a human being. Yeah, then there is a range of experiences that you can expect as a human being. Yeah. And that range is the result of the karma that you had before. Yeah. Not the individual experiences, but that you are limited within a particular range. Yeah. So and within that range, many kind of things can happen. Yeah. And it's only the really big happinesses and the really big sufferings in your life that you can attribute to past karma. For example, if you die when you're 30 years old, you can take with a fair amount of certainty that is something karma in your past life. If you have a really miserable life for one reason or other, again, it's karma in the past life. If you become absolutely fabulously wealthy, it's going to be karma in the past life. But if you have like ordinary experience, like you lose your job here, or you get a salary increase, or you have a pain in your foot, and all this experience that we have a lot of all the time. Well, hopefully we don't have too much losing our job, but these things are kind of normal human experiences, and if it is a normal human experience, it's only part of the result of having done karma to become a human being in the first place. That's how I understand it. I think that is a fairly common way of understanding this matter. Yeah. It depends. It also depends on how we see karma, in a sense, you know. Okay. The question was, who we marry, is that a result of past karma? And the answer, I think, the answer is that karma. It depends what we see as karma, but karma is basically what we're reaping now as a result of past actions, right? So if you have gotten very close to somebody in the past, attached to somebody in the past, you're going to meet them again in this life. So maybe you got attached to somebody you didn't realize who wasn't the right person for you. If you're married to somebody who doesn't work out with, then maybe you were attached to somebody and maybe something has changed in the meantime or something. I don't know. There's all kind of possibilities there. But I think that for you to say that a bad marriage is as a result of a particularly bad karma, it will have to be a really, really, really bad marriage. You know, you're talking about really, really bad, maybe violence and all these kind of things involved before it actually can be attributed to past karma.